Welcome to Siemens Innovation in the Classroom podcast series. I'm your host, Dora Smith. Listen to hear some of the brightest minds in engineering education share insights and best practices to empower the next generation of digital talent. Welcome to Siemens Realizing Innovation in the Classroom podcast series with your host, Dora Smith. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Mary Pilot of Purdue University. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, hey, Mary, can we start with you giving our listener a little background on yourself? What inspired you to get into this field of engineering and academia?
In terms of background, I'm an undergraduate from Purdue. That's where my educational experience began. I went on to get my MBA at Emory University in Atlanta. More recently, my PhD in engineering education, again from Purdue, in the last few years. But I'm not really an academic in the traditional sense. I spent a bit over 20 years working in industry, in the airline and aerospace areas, as well as commercial products and automotive. And so you might say I've been around some. And I came to engineering really out of observing my dad, who was an engineer and who spent his life in a factory, working in the factory setting. And that's what really started the wheels in motion for me thinking about my career and my progression into engineering.
So that's great. And what made you go from industry to academia?
That's a longer story. I won't say that I did so with intention, at least not years ago. It again was my dad who had influence. This time I received a call from my mother telling me that my father was about to have heart surgery. And I had left Indiana many years ago for work in industry. And so it seemed to me that it was my calling to come back home. As luck would have it, there was this new thing called engineering education that was blooming at Purdue. I'm a bit of a professional wanderlust in that I like personal and professional challenges. I like to see if I can do new things and challenge myself a bit. So academia seemed like a very foreign yet approachable kind of professional landscape. I was hoping I might be able to make a difference in that environment where, you know, impact is measured very, very differently and the time horizon for determining success looks quite different also.
So now I guess looking at what you do in your daily life, what is a day in the life like for you're in a role of being director of engineering education and also a professor of engineering practice. What does that look like?
It's a full day. It's a full day. It's different from industry. It has a different pace and cadence. That was probably the biggest adjustment I had to get used to from industry. You know, I'm the administrative head for our engineering programs, which are interdisciplinary engineering studies and multidisciplinary engineering. So there are a lot of meetings to attend. Purdue is a very large organization. There's lots of moving parts. Policies, systems, initiatives are constantly changing. And so trying to stay involved in those, understanding how those all interact with our students, their educational experience, their social experience takes a lot of time. So I'm in a lot of meetings. I also spend a lot of time thinking about what's next for our program to ensure that we're creating the next big engineering advances, whether that's a brand new discipline or whether that's making sure students have unique competencies that are important for the workforce going forward. For example, right now, you know, we're in our, I guess, about third year of launching something called theater engineering. And it's a field where it's new to so many people, but it's taking off like wildfire. And so that's just one example where we're creating novel programs that are both driven by industrial need, but also from the voices of our students who come forward and say, can we combine engineering and something else? And so we spend time there. I also teach three classes in the fall, so I'm always busy developing coursework and preparing materials for class, grading, and all the traditional things that folks might think educators do. I would say, you know, overwhelmingly, I spend a lot of time with students. And in our program here in multidisciplinary engineering, we kind of live and breathe the mantra of students first in our program. So if my door's open, and students will tell you it's open most of the time, they're encouraged and welcome to come meet with me and, you know, chat about school, chat about life, seek advice, grab a tissue if they're having a bad day. And so kind of along those lines, we know from engineering education research that's been done that providing even one single encounter with a faculty or staff that demonstrates caring can have a positive change on the retention of our students in engineering. So I just want to make sure that all of our students feel that we're walking the walk with them, and we want them to stay and be successful in engineering.
That's great that you have such a focus on making sure they're successful. The theater engineering, is that it's a combination of theater arts and engineering? Tell me more about that.
Yes, that is a combination. It has both the combination of coursework, but also some novel pedagogy in terms of how it's expressed and how the students experience it. So it's all engineering in that our program is ABET accredited by its very definition in multidisciplinary engineering. What makes theater engineering different is they're also able to experience statics, dynamics, and other hands-on practical design experiences, including their capstone, through creating engineering structures or systems to support live performing arts and entertainment. And so it's a great collaboration with the College of Liberal Arts and my friends in theater, Professor Rich Dione, who really makes the magic of this project work. There's a series of apprenticeships that happen as students become sophomores, maybe beginning with carpentry work and then moving on to having more design lead roles in their capstone. And it's just a phenomenal collaboration across the campus, and the students absolutely love it. And most importantly, they're getting work when they graduate.
I love it. And it's actually something I think one of my sons would be particularly interested in. So it's great to see you guys are doing those kind of novel combinations.
Absolutely. Follow up with me afterwards.
Okay, that'll be good. So speaking of what's next, you know, at the annual ASEE conference, you and I were on a panel on the future of work and implications for engineering education. You shared some interesting developments in millennial research, as well as some more on Purdue's multidisciplinary engineering degree program, which I was excited to hear is still going strong. Let's discuss those a little bit more. I guess to start with, Mary, can you give us a little feel for the state of engineering education at Purdue?
That's a big question to try and get my arms around. But what I will say is, first of all, engineering education at Purdue is thriving, you know, 15 years strong. The program has been able to attract a phenomenal cadre of the best-in-class educators and minds in engineering education. We're about to graduate our 100th PhD student, which is a metric, an academic metric of a program's health. So we're very, very proud of that. The range of research that's going on in our school is fascinating and very broad. Ranges from pre-K through lifelong learning. I would say that it's, you know, diversifying, even growing beyond what might be the early days of engineering education, looking at retention and issues like that, but expanding into more traditional disciplinary domains and understanding how engineering education can be a part of improving the disciplinary experience for students. Dr. Ed Berger's kind of, you know, leading that charge in mechanical engineering. We also have a global reach with people like Dr. Jennifer DeBoer and Dr. Brent Jessick, where we're looking at how engineering education can have greater impact globally with underprivileged and maybe undersupported communities around the globe. So it's just amazing to see how it's grown over just that brief amount of time.
Yeah, when you talk about research, I think I shared with you some skills gap research a PLM analyst, Tech Clarity, had done. And you know, one of the things you talked about in that panel at ASEE was a few things that you do around active learning and a team-based approach. And I wondered if you could share more with our listeners on that, because in the research we've seen, you know, in addition to some of the multidisciplinary skills, understanding things like manufacturability and product costing, things like just basic project management and collaboration are the key areas we hear manufacturing's telling us that they want new and future grads better prepared for. So can you talk just a little bit about, you know, your own personal style or the approach at Purdue to try to address that?
Well, I'll say kind of on behalf of all engineering programs that are ABET accredited, both project management and collaboration reach the top of the list of things that are important. ABET accredited programs, these are the, you know, the not-for-profit organization that accredits college and university programs, help us focus on key learning outcomes for our students. And ABET outcome number 5 actually addresses head-on the need for student development in both project management and collaboration. So that should make industry feel good that it's front and center on our list of things that we're paying attention to. What I will say is that often it seems that instructional approaches to focus on those competencies tend to be kind of tool-oriented. So if we provide students the tools and how to use the tools, that somehow they'll gain competencies beyond the toolkit. And for sure, I include tools. I mean, students need to know that tools exist and they need to develop mastery of tools. But I think industry might really be looking for something more than just tool use. That's my bias. So if I lean back on my own industrial experience, thinking about what's embedded in project management and collaboration is something that I call leadership communication and the cadence of practice. I'll unpack that a little bit, but essentially teaching students not just to collaborate to get work done, but how do we teach students processes and approaches for facing difficult conversations? So it's a little bit easy to have collaboration that's harmonious, but giving students the tools and the approaches and also the confidence and the experience to redirect behaviors that are not productive on collaborative teams. How do we, you know, start to educate them on what it takes to build social bonds on teams with teammates that extend beyond doing the work and really create the kind of environment that fosters collaboration? How do we teach them to ask good questions? The types of questions that help team members get more engaged. For example, I have an activity around this kind of leadership communication where students have to face a difficulty that they're currently having on a team or can be a social setting that they've just ignored. So I give them a framework for kind of creating this script around the difficult conversation, and they have to prepare their script for that. But the assignment isn't done until they've actually faced down that difficult conversation, and then they report back on how they have done. And it amazes me sometimes the number of students who will take the zero over facing that difficult conversation. And yet we know, you know, in industry that we don't have that as an option to just take a zero, right? We have to come to work the next day. We need to have that conversation to advance the project. So I think that's one example. The cadence of practice is really the second piece that I think is embedded in the project management. And that's about, from my perspective, exposing students to performance under pressure in authentic context. So what I mean by that is if we take the example of theater engineering, a typical capstone design project would be a student establishing with some criteria a design idea and delivering a prototype in 15 weeks to the satisfaction of the client, aka the instructor, right? But in theater engineering, they have to design and develop their solution with input from a large number of stakeholders whose demands are changing based on constraints of time and finances and other project constraints. And at the end of the 15 weeks, which is not really 15 weeks, it's really more like 13 weeks, there's a live production, right? And the show must go on, and it must go on not just one time, where a prototype might work one time, but it may not work multiple times, right? They have to do the production for the multiple days that the live show is on. And they have to make sure that their quote unquote prototype is alive and well and working and functioning in that setting. That's really delivering work at the cadence or at the pace of the real workplace. And that's the type of experience we want students to have here at Purdue, so that when they leave Purdue, they're already, you know, revved up and lined up to go to work and be successful.
You know, that sounds amazing to already teach them at that age how to address difficult conversations, how to perform under pressure. I mean, those are just life skills that will help them not only at work in engineering, but just in general in life. You know, and back to your comment about tool use, you know, we did find that in this Tech Clarity research that manufacturers really, they need new hires to understand how to use the tools to solve problems, but it's much less about how you just use the tool and more about the why and when you bring in certain parts of that tools to again, solve problems. So it's great to see you guys are addressing that so well at Purdue. You, one of the questions I had on my mind, Mary, was, you know, you guys are already doing such fabulous things, but as you look across the horizon and try to stay competitive, how hard has it been to, you know, update and reform curriculum and keep it in touch with those industry needs?
You know, it's an interesting question, and it's, you know, since I've been on both sides of the coin, it's just, I find myself kind of tormented from why can't we do it faster? And of course, we can't do it any faster than we're doing it, right? So I myself am tormented around this question. You know, the actual task of creating new curricular innovations or developing new programs requires good listening and it requires creativity. And you think, well, that's two things. That's not that hard, right? Good listening and creativity. But we've all encountered people that maybe aren't as good listeners as they should be and aren't as creative as we would hope them to be. But if we assume that we're both good listeners and we're creative in the academic environment, then, you know, the question remains, why is it taking so long? Or is it taking long? Or is it just perspective? And part of the time frame for curriculum reform and changes begins with changing organizational momentum. And this is something that, you know, the academic community isn't immune to organizational momentum. Industry recognizes how hard it can be to turn organizational momentum. So the question is, how do we compel people to make the changes before they necessarily see the need for the change? It's tricky. When I started my work on the Millennial Reset, the book that you've mentioned a couple of times, with my industrial colleagues back in 2004, I would talk to them about this and they would say, yeah, you know, I kind of understand what you're saying, but it's not really a problem. And so I thought, well, maybe it's just me that I'm seeing this shift. And then even when I came to academia in 2009, it really wasn't on the radar of academics at that time. So what I'll say is, at any given time, industry or academia may not feel that pressing need to make a change. And so how do you create that impetus when at any given time, either side may not feel the need to change? So I guess if we stand back from it, we can reframe the situation a little bit and ask, not necessarily how hard is it for us to reform curriculum, but more importantly, how do we prepare students to always be technically, professionally, and mentally flexible enough to adapt to an ever-changing need in the workplace? And how do we make sure that we create such a positive learning experience that they're these insatiable learners in ever-present pursuit of learning and the unfamiliar and the unknown without being afraid, without feeling like, ooh, if I go too far out on a limb, I'm taking too much risk, I'll stay in my comfort zone. So, you know, I think if we can help create a learning environment for students that does all of that, we'll not only be a top-rated academic institution, but we'll be able to serve society and industry better. and our students with the types of career opportunities, with the types of working associates and leaders that are always relevant and are always prepared to take up with what industry needs from our students as they graduate.
Well, very good. And I imagine you have seen a lot of change over the last decade.
In terms of the actual curriculum?
Yeah.
Lots of change, right? I mean, I think engineering education has been at the heart of that change with the simple things from learners as these passive recipients that we kind of pour education into to more active agents in their own learning and understanding. And the active versus the passive classroom has had great impact. If you think about how universities have been designed, the physical spaces weren't designed for active learning. And so really what you're seeing across institutions is a retooling, if you will, of the learning spaces to be more adaptive, flexible, and active, and to allow those spaces to adjust with the needs of the content and the pedagogical approach. And that is fundamentally a sea change.
So thinking about different learning styles and different classroom spaces to address that, and you mentioned the book. Let's talk a little bit about millennials and the multi-generational workforce. So your book, I loved it, called Millennial Reset, Reimagining a Workforce That Works for Everyone. A couple of things I want to point out about the book, but I guess I wanted to start with just what compelled you to research this area?
I would say that this was my version of a self-help book. How's that? So when I was still in industry, I was starting to see these changes in the workplace that at that point had not, it didn't have a name. Right? It was just this undercurrent or these growing tensions, but it wasn't prevalent and it didn't have a name yet. And it was forcing me as a manager to spend more and more time explaining what I thought were the basics of everyday workplace understanding. The simple things like, what does being on time at work mean? You know, those were commonly understood principles and practices. And yet, you know, those basic fundamentals of the workplace were starting to erode in ways that was quite curious and perplexing to me. And the demands, frankly, of young associates that were coming into the workplace at that time were quite different. I remember interviewing a young woman, her asking me where the dogs go during the day when she's at work. And I thought, the dogs, where do the dog, like I was trying to figure out, like, is a dog an abbreviation for something? And I'm just not hip enough to figure this out. And she says, no, my dog, where would I put my dog during the day? I thought that was just, I mean, it just put me so far back because she expected us to have, you know, some sort of pet daycare as part of a foundational, you know, fringe benefit at the workplace. And we did not have that. But I thought, boy, I'm really out of touch. And so how do I get back in touch with this new generation? And how do I prepare to onboard all these young people that are so talented, but, you know, they just don't have some of those basic foundational understandings that so many of, you know, their colleagues in the workforce have. And so it got me on the path of doing research, and the rest is kind of history.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I found interesting, you know, you start off with like a generational quiz, and it's really, you know, not about necessarily your age or which generation you fit into age-wise, but the company you keep, because I found that quiz quite interesting. I think half of mine were different than the generation I'm in age-wise, just relative to some key topics that I might view differently. Have you found that to really resonate as people take that and see themselves maybe in a new light, much less another generation?
I think it's helpful in terms of breaking the ice, because people are used to being categorized based on their birth year when they think about generation. And yet, you know, research shows that it's the proximity of the people that we spend time with that really creates that underpinning of our values and our practices and the heroes that we hold important to us. And so, you know, depending on who we spend time with, that really alters our espoused values, our newly espoused practices, and our heroes. And it's been interesting to watch people. For example, I was able to give that quiz to a group of nurses that did all sorts of healthcare service. The nurses that helped in the geriatric wards tended to be, you know, one or two generations behind their actual birth year, because those are the people that they serve on a daily basis. And so it's a very interesting phenomenon, but it makes a lot of sense. And the three-legged stool of culture, values, practice, and heroes makes sense, because even within families, we have our own internal culture. And so it makes sense that each generation is like a microculture within their larger national, organizational, professional, family, even geographic culture. But that quiz can help people see how even across cultures, whether that culture is a culture of generation or a culture of birthright or a culture of profession, there's still common values and practices that they can draw on to build relationships and affinity for each other.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting you have in there like a common ground exercise, because going into reading the book, you know, I wondered, is this just about breaking down stereotypes and more communication and just trying to understand each other better, but really maybe coming to some areas of common ground to be more effective in the workplace? Yeah, so I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, but I thought that was a good approach.
I found it interesting that I was writing it thinking, as I said, here's what I've learned about the millennial generation. And in the process, here's what I learned about myself, my own generation, and others' generations. And by the time I got completed with the book, it dawned on me that this is kind of the playbook, if you will, for trying to transgress all barriers of diversity, right? So in some ways, millennials are just the foil in this story. But, you know, if we're having challenges at the workplace because of cultural diversity, if we're having difficulties at the workplace because marketing refuses to work well with engineering, I mean, we have to find ways of reaching that common ground. And I think, you know, it's really kind of a lesson for our society right now as well to, you know, stop going off into a corner and start finding ways to find common ground.
Now, did you do this research, Mary, mainly in one part of the world, or did you find implications for it globally as you talked with colleagues?
So when I started this work, it was definitely domestically focused in the United States. As you can imagine, you know, over the last 15 years, there's been a lot of people expand the research around the globe. And what I would say is that while the evidence of typically, if there is such thing as a typically millennial behavior, right, to the extent that there are typically millennial behaviors, those are not equivalent in all geographies. But I will say that in general, across geographies, mostly impacted by technology and communication, there are differences that are seen, you know, far and wide in the millennial generation, just because of the availability of information and access to information that really makes a difference. And so that technology use has really impacted not only the practices of that millennial culture, but, you know, heroes and those people that become famous have changed because of modes of delivery, by everyone having a cell phone, by the internet and explosion of news services or commentary services or blogging services around the world. And so by definition, that's going to change people's values and how they view the world and how they view themselves in it and how they, you know, start to think about the value of work and where they want to work and how they want to work. So while it's not equivalent in all geographies, it's at least observed and prevalent to some extent in all geographies where there's technology.
You know, I think this is something you could parlay into a nice consulting business, because as we look at it, you know, even at Siemens, I think I shared with you a slide we had on three generations, but it's actually up to four now. But, you know, all these generations working side by side, the majority, I think, in our world have been Gen Y or millennials. And I think from some of the numbers you had in your book, millennials will outnumber even Gen X 3-1 over the next few years. I guess any thoughts that come out of the research that you did for companies, obviously you're focused on these students that are going to work in companies, but with large organizations like Siemens, where you've got, you know, 300 and nearly 80,000 employees around the world, lots of micro tribes, probably, how we start to address this in an effective and productive way?
Well, I think, first of all, acknowledging that the differences exist is the first step, right? There are still companies that exist that when you have this sort of conversation with them about making adjustments in the organization, will say, we don't adjust for people, people need to adjust for us. And I think that that works as long as you don't need any millennials working at your company. And neither Gen Y, who are following them as well, right? Because the goal is to not just hire people, but to have happy and productive associates working for you. So you need to, first of all, accept that there are differences as step one. Kind of the next thing I think many companies need is a multi-generational, and I would say, you know, go beyond generation, just create an all-on diversity panel where generation is just one attribute, and review policies that exist. And I'm saying start with those policies that you might think are the most typical, like promotion, to those as simple as who gets to choose the entertainment at company picnics. And really ask yourself the tough questions of who is kind of dominating those decisions and who's being left out of the policy as written. And I think many companies will be surprised when they create the space for a committee, let's call it a policy review committee, to come forward and really speak honestly about what they observe and what they feel based on how they read the policies. We take so much as being kind of written in stone when it comes to policy, but I think this is an opportunity to create open and more inclusive policies where everyone can be happier about the wording, and it just breeds that positive vibe that every company wants and that really speaks to the millennial and future generations. The second thing I would suggest is that companies really think about how they're creating information and how they're sharing information. And what I mean by that is every generation is going to have quite a different preference for how they receive and consume information and how they share information. And if you think about the value that is developed within the walls of a company, the company itself is just a holding place for the knowledge capital that's created by the people. And so understanding what preferences are for the workforce that you have is really important in retaining that knowledge capital and trying to minimize the knowledge losses, not just across divisions and units, which is hard enough, but within individual setting, you know, literally a cubicle away from each other, just because they are used to handling data and information differently. So review of company information, how it's created and shared. And then finally, I would say, you know, thinking about how the company might support organic and inorganic cross-generational co-work and job rotation. Reviewing and considering how teams are selected and formed, and not just having that happen by default. Reviewing how succession planning is undertaken. You know, that's a very mysterious and often invisible process to a lot of people in the company. So just asking yourself, should it be? And to what extent are you making sure that there's opportunities for that cross-generational co-work so that knowledge can flow organically between individuals. Thinking about how individuals are incentivized to work and share knowledge. And how can you encourage, let's say, the baby boomer workforce who wants to retire or Gen Xers who are trying to retire, how can you modify, again, work policies so that maybe they don't have to retire all at once? Maybe they could go about a phase type retirement. And in that process of phasing, you know, it offers opportunities for that cross-generational co-work so that the younger associates can take on increasing responsibility, but still have those experts resident to help them. So those are just a few ideas that I would offer that I think are good places to start.
See, a lucrative consulting business, I think, would be.
Thank you for that support. I unfortunately have a full-time job now.
You know, there was just one last thing in the book that I think sums up a lot of what you just shared was, do people need to adjust to the institution versus the institution adjusting? And you say in your book something about the individual has become the institution. And I think having that perspective helps you kind of change how you've been thinking about things from policies on down the line.
You know, when I first started seeing some of the millennial behaviors, I was very typically Gen X and cynical and maybe a little angry. I think that sums up Generation X pretty well. As I did my own reflection, as I got to know them and hear their stories and hear their approaches, I thought, what am I mad about? And I think, you know, under my own reflection, I realized I was mad that our generation didn't start this process sooner. So while I don't necessarily agree with every value or practice of millennials by a long stretch, I think that we are definitely doing our institutions a disservice if we don't listen to individuals and stop listening to kind of the average voice, because there is no such thing as an average associate or an average desire. We need to listen and build our corporations around individuals for sure.
So a couple other topics, you know, beyond getting to know each other, speaking on panels, I know that Siemens and Purdue have worked together a long time in trying to prepare this next generation of engineers. I always love to see a lot more of our customers, you know, beyond Siemens, a lot more of our customers engaging with schools like yours. And I just wondered, Mary, if you had any thoughts on either some things you've seen really work well on campus or any new ideas or best practices that we can recommend to those manufacturers around the world to get more engaged with schools like Purdue.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you again for having me today on the podcast, because as you well know, it was a chance meeting. We both kind of made the best of it, and I feel really privileged to have this time to share some information with your worldwide team. But I think those are the sorts of opportunities that we should continue to try and nurture. When you think about the vast number of conferences that we attend, both on the industry side and the academic side, I think there's far more opportunity for not just panel sessions, but, you know, joint research, sharing the types of things that, you know, for example, my research, getting that out into organizations. And so anytime we can create environments that help build these lasting relationships, I think that's important. I think the hard part between the situation is that we're long distance from each other and we keep trying to build a meaningful relationship, but just as in human relationships, long distance relationships are hard to maintain. And so Purdue's actually doing something that I find really, really novel right now. They've embarked on creating a physical space called Convergence, which, you know, I'll describe as kind of a co-working studio between industry and academia. And I've long said that if you put interesting people with a shared mission and into a common space, great things are likely to be fostered. So I think, you know, finding these environments where we can come together and spend time together so that even if people change roles, we don't lose our connectedness together. There's a friend of mine, Dr. Karen Sobel-Lojeski, talks about something called virtual distance. Virtual distance is what happens when several different types of distances start to impact our work with each other. And there's something called affinity distance, which creates emotional separation. And in her work, she talks about how when you decrease the affinity distance, thereby increasing the emotional connectedness, you improve innovation, you improve trust, you improve motivation, and even performance outcomes. So anytime we can come together to build relationship and decrease that emotional separation, I think universities and industry will see how much we have in common and hopefully, you know, leverage the best in both of these worlds that have so much to offer for not only each other, but for our students and society.
You know, that's a great point. Just thinking of it now as just a plug for the ASEE organization. I just got involved with them in the last few years and I'm on a corporate member council there. And I think any of our customers or any manufacturers listening to get engaged with those kinds of councils and organizations, it gives you a chance to meet people like Mary, to really talk with leading engineering educators, share your perspective, and like these events that happen at least once a year. There's also other offshoots, just really encourage companies to get more engaged.
Yeah, there's tons of opportunity. If you don't know where to go, if you're an industry associate and you want to get involved, you know, I would say call anyone in engineering education. They'll find a place for you to connect and to start to give your voice to a new audience. And that wisdom and that sharing is so important and only drives, as I said, drives innovation, helps build trust, and improves outcomes for our students who ultimately become your associates. So if you can't find a way to engage, reach out. Folks like myself will certainly be there to try and help you connect.
Great. So the last question I have for you, Mary, is just what are you most excited about right now? As you're probably starting a new semester here or halfway into it, what are you inspired about or excited about as you're on campus this fall?
Well, first of all, I will say that I never grow dull of being inspired by my students. Every year they get smarter. Every year they're kinder. Every year they're more aspirational with larger goals. And I don't know if, I mean, I'm assuming it's because they're growing and I'm not shrinking. You know, that's what I'm assuming. And they're just amazing. They're amazing. And, you know, for anyone who reads the news and maybe gets depressed about what they think is on the horizon, visit your local college campus. We're so lucky to have such amazing students at Purdue. And I believe most all campuses have great students that really light up the space and help you feel energized about what the future holds. So that's thing number one, kind of at a macro level. At a local level, I think some of the new programs that we're working on here at Purdue, really trying to expand this notion of theater engineering, is really, you know, taking front and center stage for me this year. So unpacking that, building a nice big tent so that we can think about areas that will be new and novel for entertainment, really blowing out and expanding things like lighting engineering, acoustical engineering, virtual reality, immersive experience, gaming, you name it. I think that is super exciting. And I think it's an area that will really make good use of the technologies that are out there in new and interesting ways and be super exciting to our students and to industry in those fields too.
Great. Well, thank you, Mary, for taking the time with us today and sharing so much from your research, your life, and what's going on at Purdue. And I look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the time with you.